Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
You know, some guy running around with like stick stones and like light machine gun can actually influence massive decisions that are made in the White House or Brussels or wherever, because, you know, these militias end up kind of being backed by a side here and there.
You're listening to War College, a weekly podcast that brings you the stories from behind the front lines. Here are your hosts, Matthew Gault and Jason Fields.
Hello, and welcome to War College. I'm Matthew Gault.
And I'm Jason Fields.
The world is full of wars, both big and small. With so much conflict and so much journalism focused on the home front, war can slip through the cracks. Jake Hanrahan lives in those cracks and picks up those stories. He's a journalist and a filmmaker from the UK. His work has appeared on Frontline PBS and HBO. He's also just launched a podcast called Popular Front. It's a great show that focuses on the niche and geeky details of modern warfare. If you want to know how suicide car bombs are built by ISIS or learn about the Nazis fighting in Syria, The Popular Front is a show for you. If you love War College, you'll love Popular Front. Jake, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me on again.
So why did you start the show?
I think I kind of felt like there was a small community amongst people I speak to, you know, whilst researching and just talking nonsense on Twitter about like various war topics. And I felt like this community didn't really have kind of a podcast for it, because it's really very niche, you know, like talking about this random militia here that nobody has heard of. The kind of things you would never be able to actually get an article published on are actually some of the most interesting things, I think, about modern warfare. So I was like, you know what, let me just do this podcast. You know, I had some time. And I was a bit bored, and I thought, yeah, I think that'd be quite fun. And it has been, you know, and it's been really fun to learn as well from the people I speak to.
What do you see that's wrong with current conflict journalism? I mean, you just said that a lot of the stuff that you're really interested in is the stuff that you have a hard time pitching and selling to some of the publications. Like, what is that, you know, what kind of stuff is that, and why aren't they interested in it?
So I think this comes down to a problem that is kind of rampant in journalism in general, not just conflict reporting. The people that are in the places of power, like commissioners or editors, a lot of them are from a very elitist background. And when they tell you, oh, normal people don't want to know about that, you'll hear that a lot. Oh, people don't want to know about that. And I think, well, how on earth do you know? Because you haven't been amongst, you know, these weirdos like me and my friends and the other reporters I talk to about this stuff. You've no idea. So I think that's a big problem. Like the kind of, there's a bit of a false narrative when you get editors and commissioners like, we know what we're talking about. People don't want this. And it's like, actually, you don't know what you're talking about often. And, you know, and you often don't know what people want. That's why journalism is in a, you know, dire state, I think, at the moment. Not to say that all commissioners are terrible. Like, there are some amazing ones out there. But I think because journalism is, and especially like conflict journalism, is so precarious right now, nobody wants to take risks. And that's understandable. But again, I just want to go back to that thing I said about like the elitism. The elitism is a big problem. So with Popular Front, what I wanted to do was kind of just make it a bit more fun. You know, I don't want it to be too formal. It can go on for as long as it goes on for. And the idea is, it's not for everybody. You know, it's not for everybody. It's not meant to be easily accessible. Everything is so easily accessible now. Like, and, you know, in my opinion, that's what brought us the hell of like, you know, modern journalism, where you get slideshow videos and garish text and you get 1 minute of information. People actually don't want that. They want really detailed stuff. And this idea that, oh, well, people have got a short attention span, they'll only watch 5 minutes. Netflix smashed that myth out of the park. You know, people sit for hours and hours and hours. I do. You know, they'll watch series and they'll just watch it for hours on end if they have time. People are not stupid, you know. I think there's this thing where, you know, it's almost like people assume that the normal consumer is an idiot. They're not. And if you give them something that's interesting and they can relate to, they'll listen to it, or they'll, you know, they'll indulge in it for as long as they want to.
Can I ask you, since Matt included it in the introduction and you're talking about stories that don't get reported, really Nazis fighting in Syria? Is that a real thing?
Yeah, it is a real thing. I mean, what you're referring to is the first episode of Popular Front, where I did interviewed a guy that knows all about the SSNP, so the, what is it, the Syrian Social Nationalist Party of Syria. And they're now fighting on the side of Assad. And they're kind of based in Lebanon. And they have this big idea where they want to fight for this greater Syria. But actually, if you look at them, their logo is a massive swastika. You know, there's no way around it. They're like, oh, it's not a swastika, it's a storm. It's a swastika. And they say that every enemy of theirs, whether they're, you know, whatever religion they are, there's the eternal Jew. So anybody who's against them is an eternal Jew. And yeah, and their leader was very, very into Hitlerism. So basically, there's this, you know, there's this this kind of Nazi group running around in Syria. Yeah, fighting for Assad. It's really weird, but when you listen to the episode, you start to realize, like, it's not that unusual considering the Assad regime being, like, harboring Nazis for years. You know, one of the last SS guys, like, died in one of their prisons after he kind of, I think he, like, pissed off Hafez, one of them. So yeah, it was quite interesting. It's quite a, like, kind of hidden bit of history in a way, I think, which they're not a huge militia, you know, and they probably haven't read Mein Kampf, but, you know, definitely the ideology is kind of the most militant anti-Semitism you could possibly come up with, even in Syria.
You're an independent journalist now. Back then you had an agency backing you up. You know,
maybe the last year or so, I've kind of come to this realization that maybe independent journalism is the only way forward for me personally. Not to say that, like, you know, if New York Times were like, hey, do you want a job? I'd be like, no, sorry. You know, like, obviously, but I think there is a big problem with having to meet these kind of goals and clicks and all that nonsense has really infested itself, even within conflict journalism. For me, I don't know, I just got kind of sick of it. You know, I got kind of sick of this weird jumping through hoops and no, that's not important, this isn't important, your experience doesn't mean anything here. And I just thought, you know what, this has turned into a big corporate machine. You know, I'm sounding like some kind of like edgy teenager, but it really is kind of that, you know, and it is quite distressing. Not to say there isn't, you know, I think there's some amazing journalism going on within these, a lot of these publications. I just think it could be a lot better. And I think, well, not a lot better, I think there could be a lot more really good journalism going on. I think this problem where, like, you know, Trump tweets, everybody starts, you know, crying their eyes out. Oh my God, look at this, look what he said. That to me, I just think this is just so ridiculous. Like, the guy's an idiot, sure, whatever, but like, come on, like, we really, that shouldn't be rising to the surface, in my opinion. That should be the lower kind of stuff you read to just be like, oh, this is funny, whatever. Instead, it seems to be, you know, like this salute thing with North Korea, like it was insane, but we already know the guy is absolutely off his nut. Like, the guy is not a normal guy. And then the fact that everybody's, to me, I watched it and he's like gone to shake the hand. He's not really judged it very well. And he's gone, oh, whoops, and just like saluted. Insane to do that to North Korea. But like, come on, like move along, like next, hurry up, you know. And that I think that kind of stuff, the fact that that gets so much attention now is incredibly depressing when, you know, there are kids dying all across the world. There are wars going on that nobody talks about. So for me, I thought maybe independence is the only way forward. And I think perhaps like 2 years ago, the only people that were like really going, yeah, I'm independent, were like kind of lunatics. You know, like you get some random weird English guy running around the Donbass in Ukraine trying to get money for some absolute rubbish that he'd said about, you know, Ukraine or the Russians. But now I think more and more people, you know, certainly amongst, you know, very respected journalists that I'm friends with or talk with, are agreeing like there's got to be another way, you know, and maybe it's this.
Where would you go if you could cover one conflict right now? What's the one thing that you don't think nobody's talking about that they should be?
Well, it's funny you say this because I'm actually in talks at the moment with a really good publisher, if it works out, about writing a book, which will basically the premise is the wars you don't see in the news. So I've picked like 10 conflicts I would go to, and there are so many, I couldn't pick one, but I think right now the Anglophone fighting, so there's like, you know, English-speaking separatists waging a war in Cameroon, and that's got so serious now that the government today just announced that he might have to, or he wants to postpone elections for a year. Kashmir, you know, I think I read the other day that they haven't had so many young men joining militant groups in Kashmir for 10 years. Like, it's, you know, it's really on the rise. I think Rojava, like northern Syria, I think it's really important to still be reporting there. The fact that a NATO-backed fighting force that US have said is such a great fighting force is now getting attacked by a NATO army with Turkey and Afrin. And then you've got like this fact they're still fighting in Deir ez-Zor, fighting ISIS, and everybody's like, yeah, ISIS is over. Definitely not Libya. Like, you know, there's like anarchy in the Maghreb. You know, it's insane. People seem to have just forgot that that's all still going on. So yeah, there's just so many ongoing like things that I think for me, it's like, okay, I get it. A commissioner's like, that's not news right now, which is fine. You know, I understand that. However, I do think the way that these things could overspill is really serious. You know, like, for example, if you look at Nagorno-Karabakh, that weird little separatist conflict that's been frozen for however long between Armenia and Azerbaijan, like, as soon as that kicks off, like 2016, it kicked off for 4 days. Immediately, Turkey backed up Azerbaijan. Russia was really worried because they're selling weapons to Azerbaijan. They got a base in Armenia. Kind of Iran kind of quietly nodded to Armenia that they'll be on their side or whatever, you know, like it does bring in everybody else. And I think that's a really interesting concept, especially with, you know, the way we are so connected now around the world with technology and whatever. Wars are exactly the same, you know.
You know, some might argue that that's exactly how World War One started, right?
Yeah. I mean, well, I mean, if you look at Rojava, for example, you could say, well, you've got Russia fighting around there. You know, there was that report where Russian-backed mercenaries, the Wagner mercenary group, actually attacked US special forces. You know, Russia are fighting on behalf of Assad, or like backing him up, essentially. You've got Turkey have, you know, basically invaded Syria in the north, and Afrin have attacked what the coalition says is their best fighting force on the ground in terms of fighting ISIS. So what, you know, and you've got France as well, like bombing, you've got all the countries in one spot. And it's like, if they all fall out, you know, it's going to be a problem. And I think they're actually, I you know, it's not going to be World War III, but I do think that it creates massive tension and rifts with, you know, diplomacy everywhere. And what I find quite interesting is that, you know, some guy running around with like sticks, stones and like light machine gun can actually influence massive decisions that are made in the White House or Brussels or wherever, because, you know, these militias end up kind of being backed by a side here and there.
Do you pay attention to any of the conflicts in Africa? I'm not talking about the Maghreb, but like, you know,
yeah.
Central Africa, Southern Africa.
Yeah. So for my book, if I ever get the chance to make it, I mean, not my luck, I won't. But if I ever get the chance to do it, I wanted to go to the Congo because, like, it's, you know, it's just crazy out there right now. I think I read there was 2 million children are at risk of starving because there's not just one conflict there now. There's like, I think there was 4 or 5 pockets of conflict that are just displacing everybody. They've got an Ebola outbreak now and they're having to stop people escaping the hospital. It's just crazy, you know, and it's one of, I think, you know, it's very cliche, but people say it should be one of the richest countries on earth because of their resources. Yet it's kind of like this apocalyptic kind of country instead, just because of various things, but, you know, meddling, this, that, and the other, all of its resources getting taken. And now just seems to be like this silent and forgotten forever war just going on in the middle of Africa, you know. And also I'd like to do the Niger Delta Avengers, which I think are fascinating. They're like this kind of rogue group in the Niger Delta who blow up oil company pumping operations because they're saying, you guys need to give us 60% of the money because this is our land. Which, you know, is kind of fair. You know, you don't just turn up and start stealing the resources without paying for it. So they've said, look, you give it to us. And they were so effective because they're all former engineers and stuff like that. They were so effective that I think in 2016, they affected 40% of Nigeria's oil wealth. Like the amount they would have made from doing it. So I think, again, tiny little group can affect things in a massive way. And in terms of Africa, the saddest thing about Africa is like, I just feel like no one cares. Like, people do care, obviously, but like trying to get a story pitched about Africa is a nightmare, man. I think it's the only like place where there's a lot of conflict that I've just never been to, just because I've never managed to convince anyone to send me, you know.
My own experience as an editor at Reuters, which I did for a couple of years, just looking at it from a numbers standpoint, virtually anything that you cover in Africa it's really hard to find the audience. That's not defending the decision that's being made avoid coverage, but it is really interesting. I mean,
it's strange, isn't it?
It is. It really is. It's like when you do a story about Africa, it's almost like throwing it into a black hole once you send it out. But of course, I'm looking
goes
at it
off
from
in Jerusalem, and everybody's on it. It's weird. Sorry.
Yeah, it really is. No.
I was just thinking like it is. I don't know. Someone far smarter than I could probably work out why it is, but I've never been able to work out why that is. But I have a theory that part of it is like the way it's told, perhaps. I think there's a big problem with, like, for example, like the other day I was watching, I love what the BBC News, I think they do some really good stuff, but I watched something, I forget what it was, and I thought, this is really interesting, yet somehow it's boring to watch. And I was like, that's a real task. Like, you've really managed to make a really interesting topic incredibly boring. And I think that's a problem. Like, a lot of people have not, like, it's just ridiculous. You know what I mean? And they say, oh yeah, well, like Vice News, how you guys used to do it, like, it's so self-indulgent. Like, there is some weight to that argument, but also you have to recognize, like, young people have grown up in a different kind of era. And if you want to catch their eye and get them interested, you might have to change things slightly, And just because some kind of, absolute mug sipping champagne in some kind of foreign correspondence club doesn't like it, so what? Like, that's a really important thing to do, is just keep moving on. And I think sometimes journalists can be their biggest enemy. I'm certainly my own worst enemy by saying this all the time. People get pissed off at me, but I think they can be their own worst enemy by putting up all these kind of boundaries, like, no, we don't do this, we don't do that. And obviously you always adhere to very strict, journalistic ethics. But when it comes to certain style and stuff like that, you need to get with the program sometimes and stop being so stuffy, because otherwise people are not going to like it. Like with my podcast, Popular Front, I've top and tailed it each week with different music, and most of it's like vaporwave kind of music. Now that might seem really weird to, some guy might think that's really odd to have a conflict, podcast, but actually that ties very well into the kind of culture of, young people tracking these conflicts, are very involved in all of that stuff. And I just thought it was cool. Like, that was it. I thought it was cool. And a lot of other people was like, yeah, it works. So I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying I'm the guy that's worked it all out. I just wish there was a bit more room within what we're all doing here to have a bit more experimentation and maybe take a few more risks,
Stories, I think, need context and characters. When we write about Africa, we often leave both of those things behind. So I think, like, the one conflict story about Africa that's actually hit in the West in the past 10 years was Joseph Kony, right?
Yes.
And that was he was a character, and the context around what he was doing was so horrifying and clear that people paid attention to that, at least for a few months.
That's really true. Yeah, that's really true, actually. Yeah, I didn't think about that. I think it kind of gave, like, white neoliberals a kind of Dr. Evil in Africa to hate and feel better for clicking something about. I think, honestly, that's why I think that got so much, traction. People think, oh yeah, I hate this guy too, so, therefore I've done something. Well, not really. But I think you're right, and I think maybe the problem with Africa is that people see Africa as a country. Still, it's like, what, Congo, CIR, it's like, mate, it's a continent. Like, and there's so many different aspects. And I think, and that's not the consumer's fault all the time. People have got jobs, they're working hard, they haven't got time to sit down and read the things we read all the time. I think it's up to us to say, no, we'll make it in a way so you can understand it and enjoy it. There's too much of this in journalism where it's like, oh, people are stupid, or they don't want to listen to it, or they don't want to know. People don't want to know. People do want to know, but they don't have the time, They don't have the time and energy that we have for this. So therefore, we should make it, not dumb it down at all. I think the opposite. I think make it really detailed so they get really interested in it, But daily news and, like, kind of breaking news and that, it's just impossible to do, Like, Vice News have tried to do it. With the HBO show, and think what you want of that. I mean, there's some great pieces still coming out, but I think it's just a very hard thing to do,
One thing that's occurred to me about Africa, and I know we don't usually talk that much ourselves, Matt and me, during the show.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Just one of the reasons why this one's different.
Oh, no, please,
like, kind of what we do for a living, as opposed to just asking people what they about what they do.
No, I definitely want to hear your guys' insight on it.
One thought I have is that, like parts of the Middle East, we have no idea that there's normal life going on in Africa. So whenever you see something that you think is just completely business as normal, it's very hard to make it interesting. So if you think that that's all that happens in Africa, then, you know, if 500 people have their eyes gouged out, then you're saying, yeah, it's Africa. That's what happens in Africa. It's the same thing in India when you have a train crash and 500 people die, you know, because of a train accident. You're like, yeah, wasn't thinking about taking the train in India. Do you know what I mean? And it's really hard to fight that.
Yeah,
we don't report really on a lot of, like, you know, Chinese infrastructure projects that are happening in Africa, right?
Like positive stuff or just normal stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
But there's some truth to it as well, though. Like I get what you're saying, but, like, I don't know. I sometimes I've heard this before, like, oh, we should do this positive thing. We should do this positive thing. It's like, well, am I going to go to the war zone where young people or whoever, young, old, whatever, where people are dying and being killed in atrocious ways, and then go, oh, let me film that guy over there who's selling some trinkets for an hour and make a story about him? Like, you know, and it's like, you're going to report on that. So there's the dilemma. Like, you're right, definitely. You're definitely right. But I think sometimes this level of violence has become normal out there because it is just, you know, so much chaos going on due to, again, like, mostly outside influences, I think. But, yeah, I don't know, man. How do you even combat that? That's a really interesting thing that people are just like, oh, yeah, yes, that happens there. It's sad, really sad.
You think we all fall, especially with Africa, we all fall subject to kind of oh dearism. You know,
we
just look at it and we shrug and we say, oh dear.
Yeah, definitely.
That's a good way to put that.
Yeah, that is a really good, I'm going to use that. Yeah, I'm stealing that one, definitely.
I stole it from Adam Curtis.
Oh, really? Which one?
I think it's a little short film that he's got just called Oh Dearism.
I love Adam Curtis.
Oh, he's wonderful. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. He's great, man. He's done some good stuff. Like, I watched The Century of the Self the other day again, like, for the first time in a while, like that 4-hour one. And it's just scary when you see the kind of things he was basically predicting is happening now. You know, it's mad.
Yeah, he's wonderful. But I could talk about Adam Curtis all day. But let me ask you again about Popular Front. I was listening to this episode right before we jumped on. This is my favorite one that you've done so far. Is about the American militias.
Yes.
And one of the things I thought was really interesting in there was discussing the way that movement is kind of fracturing. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so I spoke to a guy called Hampton Stall, and he runs a little site, like a little medium site called Militia Watch, and he just kind of keeps tabs and tracks these movements. You know, doesn't get paid for it or anything like that. And he's exactly the sort of person that I want on the show, because often you'll see CNN, we've got some expert. You know, I saw something about an expert on Christian militias in the Middle East, and there's a guy I know called Hans on Twitter who knows everything about them. And it's like, this guy on CNN, he shouldn't be there. It should be this weird guy that I know on Twitter should be there. So that's why I wanted to give these people this kind of platform, whatever you want to call it. But yeah, so Hampton was talking about kind of this weird fracturing of the militias. And I think the funniest thing about it was that, like, they all used to be real libertarian, you know, when Obama was in power, and, oh, you know, Obama's trying to bring on this police state. And as soon as Trump got in office, they're like, yeah, we love him, you know. And it's like all that libertarianism has fallen away. And I think it's quite obvious what that so-called libertarianism actually was. Now, some of them are still kind of, you know, anti-state and all this sort of stuff. But because they now have a guy that essentially they quite like in the White House and are turning up and protecting, You know, there was one instance where I think they were kind of shielding ICE officers from some kind of like protest. I mean, the ICE officers hadn't asked them to go, but they just go anyway. And that's really, really a reversal of roles, you know, considering they were meant to be libertarian militias, most of them. So now they're fracturing and you've got all these weird internal fights and you've got like there's a big group called the Oath Keepers, but then each state has its own version, you know. So you could be, I don't know, whatever, like the Flecktarn militia in Georgia and be still an Oath Keeper, you know, like under the umbrella of the Oath Keepers. So that has obviously led to like loads of people just fighting and like boomer generation just having it out over Facebook about whose AR-15 is this, that, and the other. Like, it's kind of tragic in a way and quite funny, but like, I don't know, you know, there are loads of these guys out there, these militias with weapons, armed really well, very well trained, a lot of them. And a lot of it, I think, I kind of feel not sad for them in a way, like, cause, you know, there's nothing to, I'm not like laughing at them, but you know, a lot of these guys have just got nothing to really do, I think. And they're like, we want to have, you know, we want some kind of fraternity together. So I think that's why a lot of them join it. And unfortunately, it gets over politicized. And unfortunately, a lot of that turns up in this weird kind of right left madness that's going on in America right now. But that, I think, could really blow up because, for example, Hampton spoke quite a lot about Charlottesville. And, you know, you had right wing militias there who looked like the police, you know, who looked like they had so much kit on, you couldn't tell who was police, who was militia. And there is also in existence, they don't do much, but there are now left-wing militias. Some of them are communists, some of them are anarchists, some of them are even like, some of them are like Maoists, like it's weird. But you have them, and me and Hampton were saying like, if these two groups turn up and one shot goes off against the other side, you don't even know what could happen. That, I mean, I don't know, you know, as a Brit looking from the outside in, I just think that's insane that could happen. But I don't know, I'm sure there are a lot of like, gun lovers, you know, in the US would, you know, call me some kind of snowflake or whatever it is they say. But, you know, and not that I'm even like, I'm not saying, oh, I'm anti-gun. No one should have the guns. I'm not one of them guys at all. But it just seems insane that all of these groups are running around America and, you know, forming these militias and actually doing stuff. For example, they have like border patrols in Mexico, some of them. I think Mother Jones did a piece where it showed that the police were colluding with them and that's not right. You know, that just doesn't seem right.
Well,
to me.
I just want to say that as an American, I'm offended in every way. And more importantly, what about all your football fans, man? Isn't that exactly the same thing? You know?
Well, windmilling, you know, like
Man United versus Manchester City. I mean...
Man, Margaret Thatcher destroyed football hooliganism, unfortunately. I think football hooliganism, like, I don't even like football, I don't care about it, but I think it wasn't actually a bad thing, again, in the aspect of loads of young men want to get together and they want to fight each other in private. Like, let them do it. Let them do it. Because, you know, young men have to have an outlet. No matter how much this kind of political want to make us all the same, we're not all the same, you know. And young, angry young men that especially feel disenfranchised do mad things. But yeah, I dare say, like, any of our football hooligans, if they came up against your militias, I reckon our guys would do you all. I reckon, yeah. To be fair.
Can you tell us what else do you have coming up on Popular Front? What are some of the other shows?
So I want to do an episode about the IRA in you know, the Irish Republican Army. In Northern Ireland, because people think that it's all gone away, you know, in the I think it was Gerry Adams who said it, you know, they haven't gone away, you know, they really haven't, you know, like, obviously there isn't the popular support that there was and people want to move on. However, Brexit has really kind of pulled up a lot of that, you know, they brought up some rifts, because if a hard border does go in, you know, and if it has one pole on it, you know, one toll, sorry, on it, and it gets attacked, they're going to have to put a policeman there to guard it. And then if the policeman gets attacked, you're going to have the army there. And before you know it, you've got another war going on. You know what I mean? And there is a new group now called the New IRA. Now, a lot of people are laughing at them because there are so many different iterations of the IRA. You've got Provisional IRA, which, you know, the original guys, well, not the original, but the guys that were fighting throughout the Troubles. And then you had the splinter groups, the Real IRA. And then you had the Continuity IRA. And then it became a joke, actually, in Northern Ireland, where they were like, I can't believe it's not the IRA, you know, like, for anything that happened. But now this new IRA, they are actually I think the PSNI, the police force of Northern Ireland, have said like this is a big threat. I think they said the threat was severe and they expect, you know, attacks. They've killed a police officer already. Bombs go off quite regularly still in Northern Ireland, or at least someone gets caught with one. Punishment shootings are up 60%. And that is basically where, you know, generally former militants or like current IRA men turn up and say, look, there's a drug dealer here. They drop a letter, literally sometimes drop a letter to his house and say, turn up at this time in the park. We're going to shoot you in the legs. And then you can, you know, stop it, basically. It's kind of a madness. And I feel like that's really not documented enough. So I'm going to get a guy in to talk all about, yeah, all about that. I want to do an episode about Mexico, because I've heard that I don't know anything about Mexico, and I've heard the gangs there are like have been waging war again. You know, the cartels rather have been kind of waging war again and have moved on to almost like moving around like militias. And I saw some footage where I thought it was like a division of the Mexican army, and it turns out it was some cartel. And I was like, wow, this is insane. I want to do Ukraine. You know, that's another thing I think everybody's forgot about. I think the Ukraine thing, like the episode I'll do is arms dealing in Ukraine, which is actually, you know, all the time they're finding incredible amounts, you know, massive cases of weapons just being dealt. So, yeah, I think there's going to be a lot of stuff going on. I think it's going to be, hopefully, you know, it will carry on with the pace it's going, because people seem to really like it. I think it just is what it is. It's just like a fun little podcast. Like if you're a little kind of geek and into war like I am, and like I'm sure you guys are, you know, and all that stuff, I think you'll like it, because it's just, yeah, it's just information that you won't get, I think, anywhere else. And to be honest, it's kind of, I'll be honest, the way Popular Front is in a way inspired by War College and Bellingcat. So, you know, Bellingcat, the open source researchers, because they do so much in detail stuff, and it's kind of like, I think them two things have really inspired me quite a lot to do it. And Twitter as well. Like people on Twitter have kind of just posting up cool stuff.
Where can people find the show?
So if you go to my website, it'll be jakehanrahan.com/popularfront. That's kind of just like a landing page for it. You'll find the episodes. But if you search on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts, it's everywhere now. So you just search Popular Front and it'll be there, and subscribe. If you like it, have a look at the Patreon. We've got patreon.com/popularfront. My main motivation with that is to just kind of be able to pay a sound guy, because I'm like using GarageBand to do it and it doesn't sound very good. So like if I can get that going, that would be cool. But yeah, it's going okay. So that's where you can find it.
It's a very good show. And if listeners, if you like our show, you should definitely be listening to Popular Front. And Jake, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us about it.
Thanks for listening to this week's show. If you enjoyed it, tell your friends. All of your friends. One of the best ways to do that is to post a review on iTunes or wherever you get this podcast. PB Morningstar did, and here's what they had to say. Be the smartest person in the room. Listen to this podcast. 5 stars. Truly informative. Thank you, PB Morningstar. We're thinking about making transcripts of the show available, but we want to know what you think. Tell us on our Facebook page, facebook.com/War College Podcast. War College is me, Jason Fields, and Matthew Gault. We'll be back next week.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.